Is there a secret to achieving the breakthrough you're desperately yearning for? Are there more than one secret? My guest today has keys to help you unlock the secret to achieving the breakthrough you deserve. Hello and welcome to the Brain and Brand Show. Thanks for choosing this episode. I'm Timothy Maurice, your behavioral psychology author. It means a lot that you clicked download on this. Please share it with someone you care about as well. My guest today is Dr. John DeMartini, author of the international bestseller, The Breakthrough Experience. He has a new book, Nine Steps to Financial Freedom, and a new movie coming out, The Breakthrough Experience. And many of you will know him from appearing in The Secret, the body of work that shifted how the general public thinks about manifesting what you want and need. Dr. DeMartini, welcome to the Brain and Brand Show.
I was looking forward to this. It's great to see you.
It's so good to see you. We go back almost 2 decades.
Almost 2 decades, exactly.
Yeah. When I saw your name, I think I first saw it on a billboard, and then the next day your team emailed me. So I don't know if that's,
manifesting.
Yeah. It was manifesting. You're looking good. You look really good.
Can't complain.
Yeah. How is family? How is everyone?
Everybody's doing good. Six grandkids
and six grandkids.
One in the oven. Well, the sixth one's in the oven, so.
Wow. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, congratulations.
And just 3 weeks, I'm my 70th. So I'm going to hit my 70th.
3 weeks, you're 70.
Yep.
How are you celebrating?
I'll be in the Pacific, in the French Polynesian Islands.
Wow.
Be sailing out there.
Incredible. Well, before we dive into this interview, I have a fun feature called Inside Your Mind. It's just sort of 7 either-or questions for our client, our audience to get to know you. Can we have some fun with it?
Absolutely.
Let's do it. Here we go. Number one, still water or sparkling water?
I'm a still.
Art gallery or a soccer match?
I'm more of an art gallery.
Okay. Printed book or audio book?
Printed.
Melbourne or Cape Town?
Good choice. I just came from Melbourne just a few days ago, but I love Cape Town. Cape Town's special.
It's special, right? Dancing or yoga?
Yoga.
Swimming or cycling?
Swimming.
And finally, number 7, theater or play or movie?
I'd probably take,
Depending on the movie. Well, speaking of movie, thank you, by the way, for allowing us to go inside of your mind. Speaking of movie, you've got a new movie coming out. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, I've been very blessed by this. It's already got 38 nominations.
Are you serious?
38 nominations. I was just blown away by that. And it's basically about the journey of the work that I do around the world. And it's, it's about the breakthrough experience. I've been teaching the breakthrough experience for 35 plus years.
Oh, wow.
I've done it 1,223 times.
Are you serious?
And people have asked to do a documentary on the work that's had and the impact it's had.
Yeah.
And so they filmed at different parts of the world as I traveled.
Yeah.
And it's been doing very well. We're about to launch it, but the premieres have been exceptional. So full houses.
I love it. It's funny. I had never really watched much of Tony Robbins' work. And I came across, my partner was watching him, I think it was on a Netflix special or something. They did something similar.
Yes.
And I was actually blown away. I think sometimes we take for granted the rigor and the discipline and the demand of what it takes to do the work you do around the world. So I'm really, really looking forward to this. How long do they follow you?
We hit COVID. We started before COVID.
Okay.
Like a month before COVID hitting.
Okay.
And then we got delayed for quite a while. And then once we were able to get back on a little bit of interaction, we had luckily some locations that I happened to be where we were able to film. So we filmed in Spain and we filmed in London. We filmed in lots of different places, Australia, Japan, United States.
Yeah.
So the gentleman that put it together, I really can't claim anything other than I'm just being me.
But, sure.
The gentleman put together a lovely little film. And it's inspiring. So it's got some. I expected maybe a award or two, maybe, but I didn't know that we're already at 38 and they're still coming in.
Incredible. There were in early days when I met you, you used to have this giant book.
Yes.
Do you still have that book?
36 volumes, 9,000 pages.
9,000. Tell us what's in it.
When I was 17 years old, I met a teacher who inspired me to believe that someday I could be intelligent because I had a speech impediment, learning problems, and I was a street kid living on the streets at the time, and I dropped out of school. And he's the one that organized and basically showed that I could do something more with my life than what was happening. And he inspired me to say, to decide what you want and think about what you want your life, visualize what you want your life, feel about how you want your life, tell, you know, yourself and others what you want in life, and take command of your life. Live by design, not duty. And so I started writing down what it is that I would love to do. I started with what I knew, and I let what I know grow as I went along. And it just turned into a two-pager and a three-pager and a four-pager and a five-pager. By the time you probably saw it, it was a one or three volumes. I'm not sure which one it was.
Yeah, it was a couple few volumes.
Yeah, I think three volumes then. But the volumes now, they're because there's pictures and the internet. Because when I did, I wrote it by hand originally.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
This is 52 years worth of development.
Incredible.
And now it's 9,000 pages. It has my posthumous biography, how I want to be perceived 1,000 years from now, the impact that I want to make, all the goals. I keep metrics on it. My gratitude journal, which I do every single day, every day of my life. Everything that I set out to do, I'm doing metrics on it to see, am I doing it? Am I walking my talk? Einstein said in one of his books when I was 18, I read, he said, the greatest teacher is exemplification. So I said, if I want to be a great teacher, I want to exemplify what I'm teaching. And so I want to metric it. And I've been very blessed and very to have an inspired life because of taking command of it. And most people don't realize they can do that. And I'm not exceptional. I'm just a guy that just never gave up and just kept doing it. I guess if you do something long and everybody else dies out, you end up at the top.
Do you feel there's a link between those gratitude journals and how young you look?
Do I look young?
Well, I'm looking at you and I got to tell you that I haven't seen you for a while. Sometimes if you haven't seen a child for a few years, you can just see such a dramatic difference. I don't see that much difference. And the last time I saw you in person may have been 7-8 years ago.
Yeah.
And COVID has been tough. You said you're turning 70, and I'm blown away at how, you know, you don't seem to be aging at that level that I see a lot of people aging at. And you and I both know the power of gratitude. And I'm wondering, I mean, there must be some lifestyle, et cetera, but just how important is gratitude and journaling gratitude?
Well, I was born on Thanksgiving Day.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
And my mom told me when I was about just turning 4, make sure you count your blessings before you go to bed, because those that are grateful for what they have, that get more to be grateful for.
Wow.
Now, you have background in neuroscience, so you're going to appreciate this. The medial prefrontal cortex, the executive center in the brain, which is the most advanced portion of the brain, is the integrator, according to Scientific American, October 2022. It's the seat of the autobiographical self, and it's the integrator of the information that comes in through our sensory and goes out through our motor. And it's also called the gratitude center. Mm-hmm. It's called the guardian angel of the body because it governs the amygdala's impulses and instincts and keeps us stable instead of erratic. And I learned that if we prioritize our life, identify what's really, truly demonstrated to be the most important thing in our life. And if we prioritize our life and dedicate to the highest priority and surround ourselves with people that are inspired to do what we want to delegate, the distractions and distress and the levels that normally cause entropy and aging go down. So I basically, anything that requires any form of external motivation, extrinsic motivation, any form that I need to be reminded to do or whatever, I just find somebody to delegate that to. So I only teach, research, write, and travel. I don't do anything else. My girlfriend, I told her, I said, listen, if I was to organize and have George Clooney make love with you on my behalf because I've got a busy schedule right now. Would you still love me? She says, I'll love you even more. So I delegate, and I'm joking about that.
Yeah.
I delegate everything. And I find people that are inspired to do what need to be done, but not by me.
Yeah.
And that allows you to stay in the executive center, allows you to be more objective, allows you to have less vicissitudes and volatilities, and decreases the mortal aging process, I believe. And it's the gratitude center. So you have something to be grateful for daily. That's why I document my gratitudes every single day.
Yeah.
So I do believe that gratitude, grace, a feeling of love for what you do is a confirmation of authenticity and exemplification of what you're here for.
Recently, I had a conversation with a group of friends about the Institute of Marriage. And there was this huge debate. I mean, having traveled the world, much like you, you know that there's different forms of relationship dynamics. There are different structures and systems. There are expectations around those systems and structures. You mentioned your girlfriend. Why not wife?
That's good. Well, my wife, I was married. She passed away.
Yeah.
So I have dated a few girls, but I can't say that I found the girl that competed with my wife. Let's put it that way. She's still been number one.
Yeah.
But I do have a lovely girl in my life right now, but I don't know about a marriage process, primarily because I do travel full-time around the world, either by flying or sailing, because, you know, I live on a ship.
Yeah.
And she is a very famous actress and model and singer, and she has a very crazy schedule, and our schedules are rendezvous.
Got it.
Romantic rendezvous is the best way to describe it.
Got it.
And I'm extremely busy. She's extremely busy. And so the way we have it is working right now.
Makes complete sense. I want to, for those who are locked into this conversation, who are just getting to know you, let's just kind of go back and then we're going to leap forward again. You were born in America and you had an early experience that kind of helped shape you. And I want to get to the breakthrough experiences and so forth. Tell us a little bit about your early childhood to kind of help sort of form a lot of your thinking.
Well, I was born November 25th. So, and coming up on the next birthday here. And I was born with my arm and leg turned in. So I'm not sure how I positioned, but it was just turned in. And so when I was starting to stand up, I guess 8 or 9 months, I'd fall over. And it was awkward. And so I had to be wearing braces from about a year and a half to four. I wore braces on my arm and leg.
Wow.
And that made you feel constricted. And a lot of people didn't know how to interact with you, and kids would make fun of you and everything else and kind of stay away from you. But at the same time, as you know, everything that happens in your life is on the way, not in the way. Mm. It's part of the perfection. Mm. I also found out that when I started to make noise with my mouth, it wasn't proper. And so I started going to a speech pathologist at about a year and a half. And I had to do strings and buttons in my mouth and do all these exercises to try to use my mouth properly because I wasn't making sounds properly. So I had a speech impediment. When I turned four, I got out of my braces and I was able to start to make some decent noise, mass sounds. And I got into elementary school, the pre-elementary school, and I wanted to play with the girls, my Italian blood, I guess. Mm. I wanted to play with the girls, and the teacher said, no, you're a boy. You're supposed to play with the boys. So she said, you can't play with the girls, and if you're not going to play with the boys, you're going to play with yourself in the middle of the room. So I sat kind of like a Zen Buddhist middle path between male and female and sort of an androgynous positioning. So the teacher was doing that because she wanted me to be one side or the other, you know, not be with the girls, but be with the boy.
Yeah.
I didn't want to draw army and cars. And I haven't driven a car in 35 years.
Yeah.
Cars are not my thing.
Yeah.
I have a car driver. I delegate.
It's funny how that used to sound crazy, but now it's like normal. You were ahead of the curve.
Yeah. I haven't driven a car in 35 years.
Yeah.
So I've always envisioned somebody else doing it because I could do more productive things in the back of the car.
Yes.
So I got to first grade, and that's when you try to learn to read, and it wasn't working. And no matter what I did, I couldn't make any meaning and couldn't pronounce things properly, and it just wasn't working. I had dyslexia. And the teacher first put me in the normal class and then the remedial class and then finally had to wear a dunce cap. They had a dunce cap back in 1960.
Wow.
And She said, until when you decide that you're going to be obedient and read, then you'll come back in the regular class. She thought that might help. Didn't help. And finally, she had my parents come to the class and said, I'm afraid your son has got a learning difficulty. I don't think he's ever going to be able to read. I don't think he's ever going to be able to write properly because I wrote backwards. I don't think he's ever going to be able to communicate effectively. Probably won't go very far, amount to much. Mm. So that was the, if I could go back and find that woman, I would give her a big hug because yeah. I think that was an absolutely essential component of my mission.
Wow. So much of your identity has been, when I say identity, your public identity as a thought leader has been centered around your work around the breakthrough. And I mean, I have to tell you a quick story. So early when you and I met, you took a group of students that I was mentoring through a breakthrough experience, one of them named Kanye. So Kanye was born she's born in Soweto. She had the unfortunate, both of her parents passed away of a disease, and she got into the Oprah School, and shortly afterwards we were working with her and a group of her friends. You took them through a breakthrough experience, and she had a radical shift in who she was and what she's about and her entire sort of demeanor. She ended up at UCT, and now she's thriving as a computer engineer, and she looks back at that breakthrough experience as a key pivotal moment. Are you ever surprised after all these years of some of the breakthroughs?
I still get tears every day of what I get as feedback from people's lives' trajectories that change. And that's why I've done it 1,223 times and still hope to do it till I'm 100.
Yeah.
Because I don't think there's anything for me more meaningful and inspiring than watching transformation. I just got to doing it here in Joburg just over the weekend. And there's amazing transformations, and people were, just very inspiring.
Yeah.
And I did a presentation last night at the Stanton Convention Center, and we got to talk about that. And some people stood up and made comments about what's happened in life. One gentleman, I didn't know this, but he ended up going from problem child and everything else, and his net worth is like $30 million now.
Oh, wow.
And he just was telling the story and how breakthrough shifted him. And that was 8 years ago. I didn't know.
Oh, wow.
So he just stood up. And then another gentleman says, I have 10 clinics now. And says, you at the breakthrough expanded my view of what I was capable of doing. It gave me permission to stretch a bit more.
Yeah.
So I've been blessed. I keep that in my gratitude journal. I get letters every single day that are transformational letters. And my gratitude journal is not just what I'm also grateful for, but also the gratitude I get to see in the lives to change. And I don't know, there's not everybody has a job where they get to get such a response back on a daily basis. Mm. They may have a job that's kind of routine, and they may not get that feedback and understand the ripple effect of what you really get to accomplish. You may be doing something massive, and you may not even get to know what you make the difference in. But in my business, I'm blessed to get feedback, and it's tear-jerking.
Take us through the breakthrough experience. What will someone experience at a breakthrough experience?
Well, the morning, it's usually a weekend. Sometimes I do them. I've done three in 1 week because if I've got the opportunity, I do them. And they're 2 days. They're about 26 hours for the 2 days. And I do everything I can.
So the person arrives at what time? Let's just take them through.
It starts at 8.
Okay, 8 o'clock, you arrive.
It goes to at least 10.
Okay.
And the very beginning of it is the principles.
Okay.
And these are principles on human behavior that I think give people an advantage in life to be more resilient, more adaptable, more executive functioned, more strategic, more walking your talk than limping your life, and how to clarify, according to your values, what's really deeply meaningful. Because we get so much influence from the world around us that we sometimes lose contact of who we are inside.
Yeah.
And as Jung said, it's we're living in a world where we're trying to be ourselves in a world that doesn't want us to be ourselves, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, about it's the is and ought of David Hume, and you know, what is really important versus what ought to be important.
Yeah.
And it's the conflict and that people face. And I show them how to get through that conflict and allow them to emerge unscathed by the illusions that they've been indoctrinated by many times. And so the principles are eye-opening. And sometimes that in itself is a trajectory changer.
Okay.
After the principles, which is the whole morning, we go into the practical application with the method that I developed, which is what the movie's about, a method I've been working on for 52 years.
Okay.
On how to transform perceptions. See, humans sometimes forget that they really only have control over perceptions, decisions, and actions. Their sensory neurons, their inner neurons, and their motor neurons. And so I show them how to take command of those three things and how to transform perceptions, because it's not what happens to you, it's how you perceive it.
Yeah.
You know, you can be a victim of history or a master of destiny depending on how you perceive it. So I show them and teach them a series of questions, and I make them take events in their life that they had perceived to be traumatic or challenging or invigorating and elating. And I show them how to manage their perceptions from their executive function to be able to neutralize those so they're not being extrinsically, intrusively affected by these misperceptions.
Okay.
So they're now able to take command of their experience and turn whatever happens in their life to something that's helping them fulfill what's most meaningful. So that's, once they learn that tool, then they're now thirsty to tackle all the things that they thought were in the way and the events that they judged in themselves or other people and neutralize it out. And so that tool is a very viable tool. Millions of people are using it now, so I'm very grateful for that. Then we basically go through, and at the end, we have a little session where we actually sit down and have a surrogate individual on the individual that you might have done the method on, that you might have been emotionally charged about. And then we do that to confirm a moment of authenticity and heart opening to make sure that there's an expression of appreciation and love for the event because they know they've seen it. I always say that gratitude and love are confirmations of authenticity. Because when you're judging and feeling superior, you're inauthentic, looking down on people. And if you're inferior, looking up at people, you're exaggerating and minimizing yourself instead of being yourself. Mm. So as long as we judge, we feel empty and we're inauthentic. But once we bring the imbalance back into balance and have equanimity and equity between ourselves and others, we start to feel grace. And that's a confirmation that we now have cleared the illusions and are ready for the really objective truth about what's happening in our life. And it liberates us from the intrusive thoughts of the things we infatuated, resented, and allows us to be present. And that is where the power is in planning, designing, interacting, client relations, people relations, business management, managing of money. So then we show them how to apply that into each of the seven primary areas of life, how to use that in keeping the signal strong and the noise in the brain down, how to keep wake up your ingenious, creative, innovative contribution philanthropically, how to build their business on and scale it by vision and clarity and prioritization of actions and delegations. And we talk about how to build wealth, because I believe that every person deserves to be abundant, and there's never a lack of wealth if there's willingness to serve. You know, there's no lack of opportunities to serve people.
Yeah.
There's always problems.
Yeah.
If you can tackle and care enough about humanity to find out a problem that you'd love to dedicate your life to serving, you have the capacity to be very fortunate in life. So I go around the wheel and show them how to communicate effectively in relations. I show them how to wake up their leadership capacities. I show them how to master their physiology and their epigenetics and autonomics. And I show them what an inspired life can be. And I give examples, and I make them go through practical experiences to assist them on this. So their perspective of what they're capable of doing is almost impossible for it not to expand by being there. And then I show them how to get clear about what that mission really looks like, what they want to do. So they write it until there's tears of gratitude and there's a knowing. And I show them how to manifest that and the steps, kind of a formula on how to bring that into reality and how to incrementally set goals Because many people set, when they're puffed up, they set too big a goal and too long a time frame to humble them. When they're beat up, they set too small a goal in too long a time to lift them up. But if they set real goals in real time, they tend to get strategic and they get efficient and effective and they become competitive and they become, you know, Ricardo's law of efficiency and comparativeness. So they free themselves up and they build momentum towards something. And so that's in a nutshell. We also show them how to own the traits of the greats.
Yeah.
Because nothing's missing in us.
Yeah.
We sometimes are too humble to admit what we see in others inside us, and we don't honor the magnificence of what we have, and we think somebody else has something. But the truth is we can't see it in them without us having it. But it's in a different form because we have a unique set of values. And if we don't honor the form our magnificence is in, we'll constantly compare ourselves to others instead of comparing our daily actions to what's really most meaningful. And that's where our comparisons, not to others, but to our own actions. How congruent are we with our real mission in life? That's our daily mission.
Speaking of confronting yourself, is there a secret to loving yourself?
Well, anytime you exaggerate yourself and look down on people, anytime you exaggerate others and look up at them and minimize yourself, you're not going to love yourself. People want to be loved for who they are, but that's not who they are. But when they actually realize that what they see in others, what they point their finger at is them with the fingers back, and they level the playing field. And I give them an exercise where they actually do that, where they're sitting with somebody and there's just tears of gratitude. And they realize that the judgments are gone and now they're just real with a person, another individual. When they do, that's where the power is. That's the power of love is still hard to describe, but it's very powerful. And people, it sounds almost esoteric, but it's transcendental to actually do it. And I've met some amazing people, done amazing jobs, very significant players on the game. And the ones that I find that are doing what they love and loving what they do and prioritizing their life, they're philanthropic, they contribute. I always say money without meaning leads to debauchery, but money with meaning leads to philanthropy because you feel that you can contribute and it's so fulfilling to make a difference in other people's lives. So we are pursuing challenges that inspire us instead of avoiding challenges that don't.
When you first did your first breakthrough experience versus the one you did the last couple of days, a lot has changed in the world in that period. The chances of someone standing up in a breakthrough experience in the beginning and saying I'm non-binary versus now, you know, the conversation around identity, is this something you confront in your work? When somebody says I'm non-binary, I'm pansexual, I'm not sure, or I am sure about the fact that my identity is dispersed, what would you say to a young teenager? If your own grandchild came to you and said, I'm not sure about my identity, what is a good way to approach it?
Well, I'll answer that in maybe a few steps. I was in Brisbane, Australia, and I had a gentleman and his mother, well, a young man and his mother, he was 19, and his mother came in. And the mother was very distraught because he was changing his gender.
Oh, wow.
And he had already taken hormones and he was about to have the surgical. And so she felt she couldn't do anything about it, but she said, I'm bringing him to you. Talk some sense into him. So he's trying to fix him. She was more distraught, more emotional, more projective, more angry than he was. And I sat with him and he was very reasonable, very logical. And after talking to him, I asked him about his history, his life, his childhood. When did he first having these urges, his attempts to being with girls and his curiosity with guys and everything. When I got through, his mother came back about an hour later and she said, well, did you talk some sense into him? I said, actually, I'm going to ask you to do something. And she said, what's that? I said, I want you to do a genetic test. And she said, why? I said, because I want to make sure that what his genetics are before we make a decision on this. She said, but he's a boy. He's got a male genitalia. I said, you can have 75% of the opposite genitalia and still be the opposite sex. It can go up 75% because of epigenetics and hormones. I said, let's just check. It's not that expensive. So she checked, and it was a girl, XX.
incredible.
And she just got humbled and she cried and she held her son. And she said, I had no idea. I looked, I saw a boy. I raised you as a boy. I didn't know you were genetically a girl. When she did, she says, I finally understand, and just hugged him and loved him. And they cried. I mean, they just cried. And he went on to be what he felt inside he wanted to be. So in those cases, I tried to be as objective as possible, try to not have a bias one way or the other, and try to get a sense for what's happening. In this particular situation, that was the outcome.
Yeah.
I had another man who attended my breakthrough experience that was highly charged about my language, because it's taken me a while to go from he or she to all the varieties, because there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
And so when I'm speaking, there's a lot of habitual patterns of saying, what did he say? Assuming it was a guy.
Sure.
Or, you know. So he was offended by it. And usually when I see somebody offended, they're trying to convince themselves. They're defensive, because nobody in the room really did care except him. So I confronted him. And in this particular situation, my daughter and I, she works with me, we had a private session with him to try to find out where this gender curiosity changed, because he didn't have this when he was 14. He didn't have any of these questions until he turned 19. And when he had 19, he started having changes. By the time he was 23, he was associated with people that this was more common and things like that. So he went with it. We found out that probably 20% of his motive was social. We found out that part of it was because of anger to one of the parents. We found out that he was bullied. We found a lot of him, and we went through what I call the DeMartini method on all of the issues that were underlying those, one by one, over about a 3-month period. My daughter did much of the work. And when he came out on the other end of it, he was heterosexual. So that gave me the impression that at least some people may have accumulated motives from perceptions that they'd accumulated that's caused some confusion. And the more defensive they are about their sexuality, the more I look in that direction. Mm-hmm. The more centered and present they are without emotional reaction, and they don't really care what your opinion is, they don't get offended by it because they just know who they are. Usually then there's more of an androgynous thing. Now we know in childhood that there's boys, boy girls, girl boys, girl girls. Mm. There's a spectrum. We've known that.
Yeah.
And there are tendencies. So I ask questions and see what those tendencies are at very young ages to see where they've been on the spectrum all along. And then I may actually go and ask him to check on genes. I may go and ask and look at epigenes.
Sure.
All these play a role. And also, what are the traumas and what are the fantasies and what are the experiences? I had a gentleman, I hope I'm not doing too much here on this, but I had a gentleman the other day that has an OCD. And the movement of his body was a flinging maneuver that his parents contacted me and said, we got a son, he's got OCD and he just cannot stop moving. He's constantly moving all day. When I saw the son, the movements looked like ballet.
Mm.
I mean, it was ballet in fast motion. So I started talking to him and I said, when did this come on? He said, it's now been going on for this 8 months. I said, what happened right before this happened? A girl rejected me. I said, elaborate. Well, we were having sex and she asked if I was gay. And my sex performance was not typical masculine. And the moment that happened, she dumped me because I wasn't living up to it, which made me question my sexuality. And as a result of it, I've now got this response. It started at that moment. I said, have you been rejected by other females? She said, that's the fourth one. Has that made you question your sexuality? He goes, yes. I said, I'm seeing ballet movements. Did you do ballet as a child? He said, yes. When I was 8, I did ballet. I said, did you have a homosexual experience when you were 8 years old? He paused. He hesitated. He said, yes. I've had 4 homosexual relationships. I said, you're having conflict about what to be in society. He said, and I had to sign an agreement. I couldn't say anything about it to his parents right at the time. And he said, yes, I have been turmoiled about this, and this is making me face the reality that I might be homosexual, and I don't want to do that because of the peer pressure, my parents' pressure, their religious beliefs and everything else. I can't do that. And I've been dealing with OCD. I said, right now, do you feel in any way judged by me? And he goes, no. I said, have you noticed that you haven't been doing your flinging the last 10 minutes?
Wow.
And he goes, is that because you just opened up and expressed you've got repressions? So shameful repressions often, and suppressions, unconscious or conscious, can initiate OCDs. And the reason he said on the OCD, I said, I do this movement because it makes me feel right. I said, well, that means there's some part of you feeling wrong. You're judging yourself. And that's what it was. So sometimes we have situations in our life that are childhood events, that are factors. So the gender spectrum can be gestational and already there, born.
Yeah.
It could be postpartum. It could have events that could trigger it epigenetically and hormonally. Because when we get challenged, our testosterone goes up. When we get supported, our estrogen goes up. And we can alter that expression. And then the rewards or punishments we get for our gender interactions can have an influence. So I try to look at as many of the variables as I possibly can, not judge them right or wrong. But if I see defenses, I keep asking questions and try to find out what the issues are. And then I help them dissolve the traumas or the issues that might be there.
Sure.
And then discover that sometimes they're not what they think they are. So that's why I'm a little leery about allowing somebody who's building up some of those internal conflicts to make those decisions without going through those conflicts. I really think it might be wise to have somebody go through those, not judging them, not making it wrong. But to go in there and uncover those,
to fix them.
And not fix them, just rule out the sources that might be driving it and let them honor themselves that way.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking about someone who's going into a new relationship, hiring a new person, and people go, I hope they're not bringing baggage. And I'm thinking about my own life and, you know, coming into any relationship, new teams, how do you get rid of emotional baggage? You've done some work on this. And as you're going through this wonderful, wonderful series of stories, I was just thinking about baggage.
Well, emotion is a byproduct of a ratio of perceptions. You could be hugging your boyfriend on a couch watching a movie, cuddling together. And he can have a phone sitting next to him, and all of a sudden a phone comes in. And on the phone is a girl texting a message. And a rage can come out. You're cuddling, and a rage can come out from one perception. And you're feeling that somebody is there with you, and then you're now suspecting that maybe he's not. Mm-hmm. And you feel betrayed, and you feel all kind of stuff. So a change in the ratios of perception changes emotion. I can take any emotion that a person has and decompose that into the perceptions that induce it. You cannot have fear of the unknown. You can only have fear of the content that you've conjured up in your mind at the moment you're experiencing the fear. And that content is accessible if you ask the right questions. And so we can identify the entire spectrum of emotions that are seeking amygdala impulses and avoiding amygdala instincts. We can take that and itemize exactly what the ratios of perceptions are, itemize the actual combination, composite perceptions, and we can go in there and ask questions, make them conscious of things that are unconscious, change the ratio of that, and change the so-called baggage. Anything that you infatuate with or resent will occupy space and time in your mind. The amygdala will assign valency to the content, put it into the hippocampus as an episodic memory. It'll then go in with the parahippocampal area and create cerebellar responses. We will then have an emotion to seek or avoid, open up or shut down, want to eat or want to be avoided from eating. And these emotions are nothing but ratios of perceptions. So we can take each one of those and neutralize them and balance them by asking questions, make them aware of what they've been unaware of, neutralize it. There's no intrusive thoughts. Their mind is present, and out come gratitude and love. So emotions are polarized perceptions. Love and gratitude is synthesized perceptions. They're pairs of opposites. I always call love is the synthesis and synchronicity of all pairs of opposite of emotions. And all the emotions that are polarized are the baggage. Hmm. And they run our lives by impulses and instincts.
Let's wrap this up, talk a little bit about money. You've written an extraordinary body of work, nine steps to financial freedom, wisdom, strategies, and tactics for abundant wealth. You've done a lot of work on money. Money is important. Let's just kind of go back and look at some of the origins of your thinking about money and then work our way to this specific book.
I found a way, either through panhandling as a kid, working. I mean, I had my first company when I was nine. I had nine employees. And I had a landscaping company. And I cleaned up the neighborhood and made money. So I was resourceful at a young age until I left home and lived on the streets. And then I was not easy to get a job. I could do odd jobs here and there, but it wasn't easy when you're 13. Mm. But later on, I always found a way of making what I needed, the money I needed for what I wanted. But I never saved or invested it until I was 27. And that began my journey of financial liberation, you might say, where instead of being a slave to money, bore me its master, started at 27. A gentleman walked into my office. I just opened up my office a week and a half earlier. A gentleman walked into my office who was a financial planner, and he asked if he could speak to the doctor. And I didn't have a patient at that moment, so I said, certainly. And he says, hi, I'm Jim McKinley. And I said, hi, I'm Dr. DeMartini. He said, if you don't mind, I would love to ask you whether or not you intend to be financially independent and free in your life. And I said, of course. My pride said, of course. He said, I have a series of questions that determine whether a person will be financially independent or not. Would you mind going through those questions to see if that's true and whether you will be? And if you aren't, maybe I could assist you. And it was like a little bit of an ego crunch there, but a little bit of an anxiety to ask these questions because I may be put on the spot. So he asked me these questions. I'd love to share these questions because that was the day I got grounded and got out of an esoteric fantasy about wealth building, and I got grounded and I became financially independent starting that day. That's when my trajectory change. I'm 50 times financial independent today, but it started that day. Now, he asked me, what are my total assets? And I didn't know what an asset was. So I said, well, what do you mean by an asset?
Yeah, exactly.
Because
I threw it back on.
I was so stupid, I didn't know.
Yeah.
But he said, well, it's like stock or equity in home or, you know, money in a cash reserves or this and that. And at the time, I was in debt. I didn't have any assets. And I had to put zero assets, and I had a lot of debt. Mm. So he said, it doesn't matter. See, if you don't know where you are,
yeah,
and you try to get in an Uber, and you don't know where you're going, can't go. The Uber can't help you.
It's useless.
So you have to know where you are. So the first set of questions are going to decide, where are you currently with your finance? So the first question is, what are your assets? Well, I had a negative asset. What is your liabilities? Well, I knew those. They're all my debts. And a student loan and a bank loan and a car loan. And, you know, so I wrote all the liabilities down. And then he said, number three, what is the total net worth? And it was a negative $100,000.
Wow.
So I was at negative $100,000 and I had 27 years old. And I'm kind of being humbled by a guy I don't know. You know, and we have a facade. And I had a facade.
Yeah. You're a doctor.
I was a doctor.
Yeah.
Supposed to be smart, intelligent.
You were the one prescribing.
Yeah. And I'm the dumb one there. So he asked me the fourth question. How much money per year, annually, passively, do you want to have that you're going to call financial independence? And I had made $100,000 in a year already teaching, but I never kept any of it. I bought books. I bought clothes. I bought this. I never had money working for me. I was working for it
until
that day. And so I said, $100,000. Now, this is 1982, so $100,000 was livable.
A lot of money.
Livable.
Yeah.
Now, it couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But at the time, you could.
Yeah.
So I said, $100,000. Now, I was single. I didn't have a family. I didn't have kids. I didn't have a lot of responsibilities yet. I lived in a simple little apartment. So I thought, that's pretty good. Mm. $8,000 or so a month, that's enough to take care of everything and more.
Yeah.
So I said, $100,000. He wrote it down. He said, what interest rate, with your knowledge of experience of investing, what interest rate do you feel confident you can average over the next 50 years of investing? He said, well, what do most people say? He said, what do you believe with your knowledge? I said, I don't know even, I've never invested. I don't know what to say. He said, well, right now you can get this amount in the stock market. And is that a reasonable amount? He says, yes, I think you can do that. I said, well, then let's put that down. And I put 8%. I didn't know.
Yeah.
And then he said, great, that's number five question. Sixth question. What exactly is the inflation rate you're up against? Now, the average inflation rate globally is around 3.1% around the world, but it can fluctuate to very high.
Yeah.
Like in Turkey, it's like 100% for the year.
Yeah.
And, but I put 3%. He said, now, with that inflation rate and that interest rate and the current net worth, the outcome you want, how much money do you need in investments that are assets that are earning you 8% minus 3%, which nets 5%? How much do you actually need to have the outcome you want? And I said, well, I have to think about how to calculate that. So I took the 8% minus 3%, netting 5%, and took 5% into 100%, which was 20. So I took the $100,000 and I multiplied it times 20. I needed $2 million earning 8% minus 3% to give me 5% to give me $100,000 a year. And I went, okay. So all I needed is $2 million. That was not overwhelming.
Yeah.
He said, but you need that today. That's today. $2 million. And then I went, oh, that's not $2 million someday. That's $2 million today. Because someday, if it's 20 years from now, inflation's going to need $5
million. Yeah, yeah.
So I said, all right, I need $2 million today. And he said, so now the next question is, what's the shortfall between your current net worth and that net worth? Well, it's a negative $100,000. So I needed $2,100,000 today to have financial independence. Mm. And I thought, okay. Now, this is grounding me because I was living in la-la land.
Yeah.
I was reading books on prosperity.
Yeah,
of course. How to trust in the universe kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, I need $2,100,000 today. So he said, so what is the next question, number nine, what is your strategy? Because if you don't have a strategy, you now know what you were, where you're going. You now know where you're starting from. But if you don't have a strategy, you don't have a map to get there, the probability is real low. Fantasies don't get you there. Strategies and actions what get you there. So I said, I have no idea. At that time, I thought I could save $200 a month, $50 a week, $10 a day. As a doc, I just opened up.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's a bit of overwhelm. I got all these debts. And I was really, I couldn't imagine. And I thought, well, in 2 days, I could do $1,050,000. Can I come up with $1,050,000 2 days in a row? Nope. I could do $525,000 4 days in a row. Can I do that? Nope. I could do $250,000, $1,250 in 8 days. Can I do that? No. I kept chunking it down and I kept thinking, none of those are doable. I don't see any possible way I'm going to do it. And it was overwhelming. And I was having a headache, a throbbing headache. I got my stomach in a knot. I was just thinking, I don't believe that I'm getting, I really believe that I was going to be financially independent. But when I'm really grounded and looking at it, I was going, I don't know how this is going to happen. And I didn't want to face it. It was like a breaking of a fantasy. It hurt. So I went to the bathroom and I sat to pee.
Wow.
Because I didn't understand. Yeah, yeah, I was headache throbbing.
Yeah.
I'm holding my head and I'm thinking, well, how am I going to do this? This guy's come in here and made me face truth. And all of a sudden an idea came. I can save $200 a month right now. If I grow my business, I can make it three. If I keep growing it and I live moderately, I can make it five. I could gradually get it up there because I finally realized that I needed to give me 18-year goal to get this outcome. But in 18 years, I needed 4.2 million with inflation. Mm. So I broke 18 years into 200 months, basically, and I needed $20,000 a month saved to get the goal average with compounding.
Wow.
And I'm saving 200.
Wow.
And it still seems overwhelming.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I created what is called the forced accelerated savings technique and the forced accelerated investment technique while I was sitting on peeing. And it came to my mind, and I'm going to incrementally increase this with a strategy until it starts below the 20,000, but it goes above it eventually. And I'm going to keep growing and scaling up my business until I accomplish this. So I went from 200 to 300 3 months later. I made it 500 3 months later. I made it 750 3 months later, and my business was growing. I made it 1,000. When I hit 1,000, I actually felt like, And I ran a projection. I'll be a millionaire in 34 years. But at least I'll be a millionaire. And then I didn't stop there. I made a commitment to increase my savings and investments 10% every quarter. So now it's 1,100 per month. And now it's 31 years. 1,210, 28.2 years. 1,344, 25.7 years. And I kept increasing it until I was now saving 2,000, and I'm down literally at 16 years. Then I kept increasing it. When it hit 4,000, I was down to only 8 years away from my first million.
Yeah.
And I now realize I'm in my 50s. I can definitely be a multimillionaire if I stay with it. But then my loan stopped. I didn't have debt. I stuck all my loan that I was paying right into the savings. And now I accelerate, and then I kept doing the 10%. So now I'm at $4,800 a month, and I'm now going up 10% every quarter. And it went up to 9,000. It went up to 16,000, 32,000, 64,000, 128,000. 1 month I did $256,000 in savings after cost and everything. And I scaled up my business, and what I never believed that would have been possible when I started. But it's not how much you have, it's how you manage what you have. And it's the habit of managing it. And once I started a habit, I incrementally just kept growing it and kept prioritizing my business, delegating more things, making myself more efficient, going and wanting to serve more people, gathering more docs working in my company. And I just kept leveraging it until I achieved, at 36, I was financially independent, and now it's 50 times financially independent. So all I can say is that ground yourself, get real, and know that if you incrementally build momentum step by step, anybody could get wealthy.
And you take these 9 steps to financial freedom. Give us, you know, one of the steps that you find to be
essential. Those were the 9 steps.
Those were the 9 steps. Got it. If you went back to when The Secret was first published. You know, many people around the world, as I mentioned earlier in the show, they know the book, they know the movie, etc. If a camera was facing you with the benefit of what you know now, would you have said something different? Is there a new secret?
Well, I don't think so. I filmed for 7 hours and 30 minutes.
For The Secret?
For The Secret, and I was in there less than a minute. I think I have a minute's worth of film in there. What I said and what many of the other speakers said is not what the movie ended up being.
Really?
Originally, The Secret was a 2-hour primetime television special on Channel 9 in Melbourne, Australia. She used to work with Channel 9, and that's what it originally was going to be. And we did a commercial advertising it, and I got to be in the commercial. I was speed reading a book with tears coming out of my eyes, trying to find the secret of the universe kind of thing. Mm. And the Commonwealth Games bought out the time it was supposed to launch. And so Rhonda Byrne basically thought, she was in France at the time, and she was trying to think, well, what do we do? We just got booted out for the launch of this movie, this special. And they decided what we're going to do is we're going to reformat it. We're going to dilute it down. instead of doing a series that we had planned, we're going to compile it and re-edit it and water it down for the masses and go out on DVD. So that was a last minute thing that, and then they put an ingenious marketing game together where they gave people the impression that it was popping up all over the world. And it was a website that showed where the secret's being watched. It was just something they made up.
Genius, yeah.
But people thought, oh my God, what is this thing? Mm. Ingenious marketing.
Yeah.
And it went viral and it was watered down. And when I first saw the movie, I was a bit disappointed.
Yeah.
Because there was no depth.
Yeah.
But her genius was it reached the masses at the level that was needed.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about everywhere people were watching this thing.
The whole planet.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And I was very blessed to be in it because I got to get more outreach. But at the same time, I was usually having to clarify things that weren't clear.
Sure.
Because I would have people come up to me and say, Dr. DeMartini, I've read the book 6 times. I've watched the movie 20 times. And every morning I go out to my mailbox and there's still no check, no million-dollar check in the mailbox.
Yeah, yeah.
What am I doing wrong?
Yeah.
And I would say to him, I said, well, if you considered working, doing something to serve people, because the odds of creating money from doing service is a lot higher than gambling on the fantasy that you're going to go out and get a check from your grandparent. So there's a lot of misinterpretation. And because of the way it was done, it didn't put a lot of emphasis on action and strategies.
Yeah.
Even though it was strategically acted on to get the movie out.
Yeah.
So I was constantly doing clarification presentations, but I mentioned that in my filming. And what's interesting is as the day the movie came out, Rhonda was attending the Breakthrough Experience.
You have got
the
to
the actual
be kidding.
Day it launched.
You've got to be kidding.
And she came up to me out there because she had an issue with her daughter that she wanted to resolve, and we resolved it. And her daughter came the following day, and it was the reunion of them because they hadn't been talking for a while. And she came and she says, John, how do we not put what you're saying into this movie? I said, well, because you filmed 33 people for this movie, and they all had different things to say. And in order to ingeniously put it out the way you did, you had to filter that together. And some of the things I say doesn't quite match some of the other things that people say. And so I got what I'm saying is didn't really quite fit in to the movie. You can have great information, but it doesn't fit into the movie. So I wouldn't not say anything in the interviews any different. But probably I would speak up and throw out the possibility that maybe you could put a series together in greater depths. And because I think the reason why it never came out with a sequel, although they did another one, How Thoughts Become Things, that I got to be in, is because of the backlash. Because you'd think, well, you would do another movie quickly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it never did because of the challenges that came about.
Well, I guess it's been almost 20 years, right?
It's 18 years.
18 years. And your breakthrough movie probably is the next level of that secret.
I think the breakthrough experience is definitely more in depth than what the movie is.
Yeah.
Everybody has different levels of awareness and desires and learning. And my approach is just one approach. What I do is just one thing. And it's probably not resonant with everybody, but at least it's been resonant with enough people for me to be fulfilled in life. But each of the speakers and teachers all have different angles and ways of approaching things, and they help serve each audience. So I don't know if I put out my movie that it's going to go as viral as The Secret. Probably not. I think it's a little bit more cognitive.
Sure.
It's more cognitive, and it's there's more accountability and self-reflection required.
Yeah.
And not entertainment. It's more work and less entertainment.
Yeah.
I don't have a genie in mind.
Yeah, yeah. When you are about to go to bed, you know, you've spoken to your family and colleagues and so forth. Do you fear aging?
Fear
aging.
I was standing in the bathroom one time just out of the shower, and I happened to have a mirror at the hotel I was at where you could see the front, side, and back. And I saw, excuse the expression, an old man's butt. And I went, who is that?
Yeah.
Who is that person? And I realized that I, without really paying a lot of attention to it, had not been working out. And so I, as a result of that, thought, that wouldn't be appealing to my partner.
Mm.
It's not appealing to me. And is it something I can't do anything about, or is it something I can do about? And so I decided I was going to do some workout to see if there was something I could do about it. And I can. And so now I do about 1,200 butt lifts, enough where if I was to walk backwards on my elbows and my legs, walk upside, you know, facing up, I could pick up coins with my butt today.
Yeah.
So am I aware of aging? Yes. My hair's receded. My gums have receded. My prostate is letting me know that I probably haven't been as active as I could. There are definitely things that go on when you're 70 that are humorous.
Yeah.
But some of those things you can do something about, some you may not.
Yeah.
So they say have the blessing to do when you can make a difference, do that. And when you can't, embrace that. So I try to do that, and I work out. And tomorrow morning I'll be doing my workout and making sure that when I look in the mirror, I don't freak out and look in the mirror.
You know, the reason I asked is because I was thinking about the idea that what a gift it is to be able to do the work we both do.
Yeah.
And the thought of not doing that sometimes freaks me out a little bit. You know, I love waking up, having conversations, engaging, teaching, sharing. And, you know, the focus on it keeps me kind of locked in and so forth. But I really love people. And, you know, it also drives me to work out. It drives me to feel healthy, to make sure that I can be my best self when I show up in front of people. And I want to say thank you for investing in yourself so that you can show up and continue to share your gift with us. And, you know, in closing, I interviewed a guy who wrote a book called Chatter. Ethan Cross, Dr. Ethan Cross from Michigan University, a neuroscientist. He's got a lab there in Michigan. He was talking about quieting the noise. And I've been thinking a lot about social media and how much the algorithms have got people locked, like, and how much it's disturbing people's kind of mental, emotional equilibrium. Is there a secret? Is there something we can do to help people who are just obsessed over social media?
Well, no one will do something unless they perceive that there's more advantage and disadvantage out of doing it. So they're somehow perceiving the advantage. Identifying what values are being met by doing it that's drawing them impulsively with their amygdala into doing that is an initial step. And then looking at viable alternative ways of getting those same needs met, because there are ways. I found that I'll use this analogy. We'll use eating as an example. If we have a Friday night or Saturday night, we're more likely to overeat or drink or whatever on a Friday and Saturday night because we don't have anything possibly busy or important to do on Saturday and Sunday. But on Monday, if we're going to work and it's important for us to be present, we'll be more disciplined on Sunday night. So I found out that if we find out what's really highest in people's values and we fill our day with high priority actions that inspire us, we stay in the blood glucose and oxygen goes into the medial prefrontal cortex, which is the executive function. We stay governed and we're more disciplined and more moderate and more rhythmic and consistent. The second we are not doing something that is deeply meaningful and there's nothing on our plate that's important to do, we're vulnerable to the amygdala's impulses of immediate gratification. And immediate gratification, impulsive and compulsive addictive behaviors are a sign of a non-fulfilled highest value. So prioritizing your life, filling it with really important things. Imagine a woman who's about to get married, and 10 days beforehand, she's going to eat moderately. She's going to work out. She's going to make sure she looks perfect for that wedding dress day. The night of the wedding, once the pictures are taken, she'll drink, she'll overeat, because her most meaningful moment is now gone. So if we don't fill our day with high-priority actions and inspire us, we're more vulnerable to the amygdala's impulses and externalization and stimuli that is now the social media. My advice, if you're going to use social media, post something that's deeply meaningful and focus on what's deeply meaningful and prioritize what you do. If you're not prioritizing your life, you're going to let the external world run your life.
You know, what? One of the things I'm most grateful for is LinkedIn has now allowed us to schedule posts, much like emails. So I can schedule that it goes out and I don't have to be there. Dr. DeMartini, thank you so much for joining us on the Brain and Brain.
Thank you for having me on your show, and it's great to see you.
It's good to see you too. Thank you.